Hello. This is a fiction nonfiction podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Bibi Ganeshanathan, also known as Googie, author of the novel Love Marriage.
And I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant. Today we're taping at the Miami Book Fair. This event will be aired later as an episode of our show, which you can find by searching for fiction/non/fiction in your favorite podcast app. It will also appear on our YouTube channel and on LitHub's virtual book channel.
And today, we're thrilled to be talking to Ha Jin. Born in China in 1956, Ha Jin was a teenager when China entered the Cultural Revolution, and he became a member of the People's Liberation Army at the age of 14. His novel Waiting, which won the National Book Award and the Pen Faulkner, was based on his experiences during his five-year service in the Red Army. He was awarded the Pen Faulkner again in 2005 for War Trash. To date, he has published 9 novels, 4 collections of short stories, 4 volumes of poetry, a book of essays, and a biography of Li Bai. A fellow of both the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Letters, he's also received the Penn Hemingway Award and the Flannery O'Connor Award. His most recent book is A Song Everlasting. His work has been translated into more than 30 languages, and he is a professor at Boston University. Ha Jin, welcome to the Miami Book Fair and to the show.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here. Happy to meet you in person, Vivi and Whitney.
Thanks for joining us. Very early on in A Song Everlasting, your protagonist, the Chinese singer Yao Qian, am I saying that name right? Tell me how to say it.
Yeah, Yao Qian.
Yao Qian.
Yes, you're very close, yes.
All right, that close is as good as I probably will get. Is on tour in the U.S. and leaves his own group, the People's Ensemble, to accept a separate invitation to perform at a concert in New York. He wants to put the $4,000 fee toward his daughter's education. When he gets back to China, however, his superiors tell him, and I'm quoting here, the show was mainly organized by Taiwan's Pan-Green Coalition. This means most of the sponsors and organizers belong to the Democratic Progressive Party that advocates Taiwan's secession from China. By rule, we are not allowed to mix with them, end quote. So he's in hot water. And there's a lot of nuanced language here. For instance, since when did progressive Democrats become the most dangerous political party from a Chinese point of view? After all, I mean, that's a party that would be most sympathetic to socialism and communism. Wouldn't the Republicans be more upsetting?
Taiwan, the opposite in Taiwan is nationalist, more conventional, because they were the party who was defeated by the communists. And so, but the Democratic Progressive Party is younger. Basically, the base is the local natives, Taiwanese. So as a result, the mainland China, they try not to deal with them. But on the other hand, they're getting more popular. But at this moment, they are in power, in fact. They often can defeat the nationalist party. And so that's the situation. It's different from the States. In the States, the two parties, I think the Chinese government prefer the Republicans, not the Democrats. That's the situation, different situation. They feel that Democrats are somehow more difficult to deal with.
Interesting. So speaking of right now, I was reminded as I was reading of a headline from an October 6th article, which was on NPR's website. And the headline was, Taiwan says tensions with China are at their worst in 4 decades. Do you think that's true? And if so, can you talk a little bit about why?
Yes, it has been true. Because convention, for the last 2 or 3 decades, China often threatened to basically always view Taiwan as a state, a province, not an independent country. But in recent years, and I think more Taiwanese people, especially the younger generations, they really want the independent country. In fact, it is a country de facto. It has everything, also vibrant democracy there. And so as a result, the Chinese government, and especially after Xi Jinping came to power, he viewed this as his duty, his responsibility to reunite the country. I think he is a selfish man. He wants to at least to be equal to Mao. But the only way to achieve that is to basically to unite the country. The reunion might justify his great status. Other than that, he didn't have another opportunity. So that's why the mainland China has become very, very aggressive.
Well, it's very interesting because the Chinese government has sort of maintained that officially that Taiwan and China are part of the same country, but in effect they are not, and hasn't insisted on actually trying to reunify them. But you think that he really will do this now or do something militarily to try to make this happen? I mean, how is it going to happen? Other than just, I mean, recently there were some planes that were flying in Taiwanese airspace, but that's a gesture, but it's not actually going to reunify the countries.
You're right. It's just a kind of acting. But the truth is, if really it depends on the power struggle within China. For instance, if Xi Jinping is unlikely to continue his in his position as the number one man in China, and he might start a war and be really aggressive with Taiwan as a way basically to divert the public attention, also can give him kind of justification for even put the election on hold. So there basically it's really depends on the inner power struggle. Also, I think American, the U.S., the U.S. attitude, position, or action or is very important from the U.S. The U.S. sometimes is really sometimes very aggressive, sometimes very wishy-washy. So as a result, the Taiwanese were confused. They got intimidated time and again. And also they were betrayed a few times. So I don't think they trust the states completely. That's another problem. And so there are a lot of things, at play. For instance, when the Afghanistan debacle happened, the Chinese government basically viewed this as a weak moment of the United States. Basically, they were telling other countries to see, look, what the states, the U.S. has done. So you can't depend on the United States. So really, it's not just Taiwan and the mainland. The United States is the major force in this situation.
It seems to me like so much of what we're talking about is a kind of, interpreting political code. What do certain gestures and actions mean? And I think one of my favorite things about A Song Everlasting is the way that it also depicts political codes of diasporic communities and cultural engagements. And as an Asian American artist in the diaspora, I've had to learn that some invitations, while they seem on their surface not to have agendas or political effects, in fact, they do. And as we've discussed, Yao Tian first gets in trouble when he accepts an invitation from a group that he perceives as apolitical or at least safe, which is called the Great China Cultural Association. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the politics of the Taiwanese and Chinese and Hong Kong diaspora, speaking of U.S. power in a different form, and how they relate to each other and battle over nationalism, and how you decided to portray these communities, which are also his audiences.
Yes, and he was totally lost. It was very complicated. Traditionally, most of the communities, in fact, were dominated by Taiwanese immigrants. The nationalist party was a big part of it. But in recent years, because mainland China, a lot of immigrants have more money, and so the government has more influence. Gradually, they are taking over. So there were always battles between the two, and the Chinese embassies and consulates were often spend money too to buy a different group. And on the other hand, I think the Taiwanese nationalists or the Democrats, the social, the progressive Democrat Party, they were very sophisticated. So they were younger. So I think they know how to respond to the U.S. Public. So as a result, it could be very ugly. For instance, whenever there was a Chinese a delegation or national leaders came to the States, and there were all kinds of demonstration. Some people would even block their mortgages by throwing themselves under the wheels. They knew that they had to stop. I mean, the official cars had to stop. But it happened every time when there were top visitors to the States.
One of the fascinating things about this book is like figuring out all these political perspectives. And I already messed up one thing earlier where I was thinking about when you talked about the progressive Democrats, I assumed you were talking about the American progressive Democrats, not the Taiwanese progressive Democrats. So my apologies there. But and that your answer explained that perfectly clearly. But like your main character, you know, you grew up in China and ended up staying in America. And a lot of this book is about the challenges that an artist like Chen feels. And he says often, I'm not a political person. I want to be a free artist. But his art keeps getting politicized, whether he likes it or not. Has that been your experience as a writer?
Yes, I think so. That's clear, because you can't be apolitical. That's impossible, right? The very fact that you exist as an artist outside China, that is already a political phenomenon, right? I think what the authorities are afraid of is not your political position, it's that you can live decently as an independent person, because that is really, in that way you can become a model, basically to refute the lie. The lie is, in fact, started by Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister. Without your country, you would be nothing. So the Chinese the government always, for decades, they repeat the same slogan. That's why if an artist can just exist on their own, that fact alone is a political statement.
It really interested me, and this may sound, I've read a lot about China. American journalists write a lot about it, but the simple fact, the original turning of the book is about, Chen taking $4,000. He takes a big risk for $4,000, right? Mm-hmm. And we're always talking about China has a great economy. It's very powerful economically. Americans think that, but that's a lot of money to him, and that really surprised me. A well-known singer needing $4,000 that badly. Is that how it works economically for someone like him?
Yes, I think it's still the case. Okay. Because he has a regular salary, that is very low. And that's why $4,000 would be like a four-month salary to him. But usually they have other kind of income. That's why he wants to emphasize he must be a free, he must be able to perform inside China and outside China. That would be essential for him. So that would be another kind of income. But that, I think somehow that now is severely restricted in recent months.
Well, I mean, that's another way of the state saying, like, we're important to you, is making sure that you're not financially independent of the state, I would guess, right?
Yes, that's clear. In fact, in my own experience, it was clear that whoever, if you don't cooperate economically, we would never let you benefit. That's the state's position. That was very clear.
I mean, I think one of the moments when I felt the most sympathy for him was there's a moment where he's singing and he's thinking of his mother. And he's interpreted as kind of, and he's singing with tremendous feeling, and he's read really badly by the audience misinterprets his feeling. They class it as, patriotism or kind of great feeling for motherland, whereas he's thinking of his personal life. And that's not the only moment that happens where he's, he's thinking of his daughter, he's thinking of his wife, he's thinking of his mother, he's thinking of his sister. And, he takes an action, and it's read within the lens of politics.
Yes. Yes, it's personal. Very often, in fact, we get into political situation for personal reasons. And that's very clear. And nobody could see him as a person, the personal grief. But it was interpreted as a public, collective manifestation of collective emotion.
And as he becomes more and more savvy as a performer, he starts to make different choices. And I wonder, you know, in his case or in your case, how much of the politicization of his actions has to do with emigrating from China specifically? Because in the US, you know, he's invited to give a concert for a Falun Gong connected organization. He kind of has to do some detective work there to figure out what's going on. In another situation, he has a personal point he wants to make. So he chooses to align himself with a different group to make a point about what's going on in China. He performs at events that commemorate the Tiananmen Square massacre. And the whole time, the Chinese government is putting different kinds of pressure on him. And I wonder if you would read a section about that pressure for us.
Okay, sure. And in fact, they really try hard because he is an artist that he doesn't have a business. It's not like other. If you're a businessman, we can give you a great deal and you pay less for a lot of bonds or property. But he is just an independent artist, so they try to buy him basically. And this, so when a businessman approached him and they made appointment for at a tea house, and this is on Northern Boulevard in Flushing. So he went to the tea house to meet the man, and Gary Hong. Okay. Harry Hong took off his glasses, revealing his hooded eyes. He said he'd been a longtime fan of Tian's and owned all his emblems. He had an odd accent Tian couldn't place. Probably he was a Korean who had lived in China. There were many Koreans in Flushing who came from Yanbian, the Korean autonomous region in Jilin province. His rugged face indicated that he must be a northerner, probably a businessman, as his expensive suit showed. "I'm here now, Mr. Hong," Tian said. "I hope we have something interesting to discuss." "I have a business proposal for you," Mr. Hong said, leaning his lumpy face in. "Actually, the proposal is not from me. I'm representing a client." "Who's your client?" "I can't name him or them, but I can put their terms on the table for you to consider. My clients would like to offer you a sum of money in exchange for your cooperation." "What do you mean by cooperation?" "Stop performing outside China altogether." He grinned, revealing a gold crown in the back of his mouth. "So your clients want to buy my voice, my silence?" "You can put it that way if you wish." "Well, I've never heard such a proposal before. Tell me, how much is my silence worth?" "They can offer you $4 million, 4 million yuan or dollars, certainly US dollars." Tian shook his head, too dazzled to speak. "Think about this, Mr. Yao," Harry Hong went on. "This is an extraordinary offer, isn't it? I hope it's acceptable to you." Finally, Tian got his wits back and said, "Let me sleep on it, all right? I can't decide now. Of course, take your time, but let me make it clear that once you accept the offer, you will have to abide by our agreement. If you break your word, my clients will ruin you and your family. They have infinite ways to do that." He took a pen out of the inside pocket of his jacket and scribbled a phone number on the back of his business card. His index finger had no nail. Its tip merely a tapered stump. "I understand," Tian said. I'll let you know my decision soon. Mr. Hong knocked back the remaining espresso and then handed him the card. Here's my mobile number, and you can call me anytime. After exchanging a few pleasantries, Tian decided to leave. Mr. Hong assured him that if he took the offer, the money could be delivered in any way he preferred. Tian told him he appreciated that and would figure out an appropriate way. Then they stood up and said goodbye. Mr. Hong headed to the men's room, his olive green trench coat still draped over his chair, while Tian turned from the door. $4 million would be enough for him and his family to live on comfortably for the rest of their lives. He'd better talk with Shuna, and they ought to consider it carefully. He emailed her so that he could make everything clear to her. He wrote, "They would like to buy my voice, my total silence, for $4 million. We must discuss this before I answer, Mr. Hong. I'll call tonight." He thought Shuna would reject the offer immediately, but on the phone, she sounded excited. She asked how they'd pay him. And they could deposit the money into our joint account in Beijing, he told her. The delivery can be arranged according to our preference, Mr. Hong promised me. Gosh, I never thought they would spend so extravagantly. It's not their money to begin with. They wouldn't give a damn about whether I'm worth that much. I've heard that the government is flush with so much cash in recent years that they worry about how to spend it. They even put a huge TV screen in Times Square to show what's going on in Beijing. Someone in power must be uncomfortable about my presence among the dissidents in America and wants to rein me in. My performances here might undermine their grand propaganda plan. What do you think I should do? Logically speaking, if you love Kingking and our family above everything else, you should consider the offer seriously. With $4 million, our family will be all set. We'll have funds we need for Kingking's education abroad. We can also consider investment immigration to the US or to Canada. I've heard that if you plunk down $500,000, you can get a green card within 3 months. In short, this is a great opportunity. He was taken aback by her enthusiasm. He had been tempted by the offer, but was counting on her to support, to resist the temptation. Yet what she said perplexed and unnerved him. He did love his wife and daughter, and he knew that he had brought them a great deal of stress lately. But this offer was a different matter, and he felt it shouldn't be confused with his devotion to his family. Tingting and Shuna had their lives, and he had his own. How could he sell himself all at once for their comfort and security? He grew quiet on the phone, unable to express these thoughts that might upset his wife. "Well," she continued, "it will be your call, Tian. No one but yourself should decide what to do." "What if I were to turn down the offer?" he asked. "I will understand and won't blame you. Let me say this, if you love your daughter unconditionally, you should seriously consider the offer. Of course, you have your own ego, your own demons that you have to wrestle with on your own. Okay, let me stop here. Sorry, it's a long scene.
Yeah, I
but
think
this.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, please, maybe.
Oh, I just was going to say, when I first read it, I just found it very stressful to read.
Yeah, because he's a national figure, so it's a lot of money for any artist, but he couldn't sell his voice that way, and he would be nobody. But it's on the other hand, the Chen's Gum over the years really started this for a long time. Not everybody was worth millions, but usually they would give a person like tens of thousands of grand, or even half a million, basically want the person to start a business or something on their own. And then eventually the government would use them, make good use of them. So in his case, we know that he is such a big star, and even the number one, the president, Jiang Zemin, had night time snack with him. So if one of the top leaders expressed interest or dissatisfaction about his being abroad and performing outside China, and all the subordinates and the underlings would figure out a way how to bring him back. So if that happened, money is not an issue anymore. Because for a lower ranking official, this would be a way to show their ability to their superiors. Also, the money is really perfectly legitimate within the scheme of the grand propaganda plan. So it's different situation. He's exceptional in that sense.
I know that people will be shocked, but my advances for my books are not $4 million. I was trying to think, like, what would happen if somebody offered me $4 million to not ever write a book again?
Yes, but I think most of the writers wouldn't take that kind of because you can't deal with the devil, right? You can't do that. Yeah. Not only that, the great poet Auden, W.H. Auden, I think the Nobel Prize committee, they asked him to sign a kind of agreement about something he should not say. He refused. Later, he regretted, saying he needed the money. But there was nothing like that. You stop writing poetry. So in other words, in terms of psychology, it is perfectly legitimate for artists to refuse.
Yeah, I think I found it so realistic, their conversation, or I don't know, that's how I would imagine, because it is such a lot of money, and it's outlined the way that it would make a difference to them, and the way that they kind of wobble in that moment. And that's just one kind of pressure that they face. He also begins after a while to wonder who around him might be watching him and from what position, which also seems to put some psychological weight on him.
Yes, people around him, you don't know who is employed by the Chinese government. And that happened. In fact, that happened. And, and that's, I think it's also true within the immigrant community. You don't know who are backed by which part, which faction within the government. I mean, by Taiwan or mainland, or inside the Communist Party, there are different factions. They would have their own representatives in different groups.
And then, of course, this creates an atmosphere where people in the same communities are reporting on each other, which...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just seems to really, complicate. I think people assume that diasporic communities are monoliths that get along, and to see the reality of it portrayed was really.
Yeah, that's very different. In fact, in the States, we have like the Cuban community. We can see that many of them, they are very, very aggressive. They are opposed. They are opposed to communism. But in the Chinese situation, it's quite different because the U.S. economy and Chinese economy, they overlap, entangled. So as a result, even a lot of U.S. officials, in fact, have been bought off by the Chinese government. You can't tell who is helping the Chinese government.
Yeah, I think as I was reading sort of I would every once in a while lift my head up and tell my partner what my guesses were, who was who. And I think another really fascinating thing about the book, I'm a musician, perhaps not a very good one, but a lifelong one. And I so loved reading the descriptions of the music and also tracing the politics of the music in this book. And along those lines, and sort of also in the vein of what we've just been talking about, you know, what influence do Chinese officials have? There's an amazing reference to at least one real life incident in the novel. The pianist Lang Lang plays a song containing anti-American sentiment, and the song is called In Praise of Our Motherland. And this happens at the White House in 2011. And it did happen at the White House in 2011 when Hu Jintao, who was then China's president, visited. And at the time, there were rumors, you know, I was reading the news coverage about this, there were rumors that Chinese officials had had a hand in picking the music. And also many people who said, Lang Lang didn't know. It's just a song. And the song comes from a movie in which Chinese soldiers fight US soldiers during the Korean War, hence the anti-US sentiment. And I wonder if you would read once more for us, read your version of this event, and tell us about writing this song into the book.
In fact, I'm sure, I'm positive that Lang Lang knew. He knew, and because there was such a popular movie. We all saw it. For over the years, there were not many movies available for the general audience. And it would be impossible for him not to have seen this movie. Okay, I want to read a few paragraphs about the response. And the protagonist, Yao Tian, he had a good friend who was a pipa player. And Tan Mai, originally she was invited. This is fiction, okay? She was invited. She was such a great performer, a musician. She was invited then, but she wouldn't do it. So that's why this was revealed to the public. So a lot of people were angry at her. And Tian was trying to help his friend. Okay, Tian had read about the Tan Mai's trouble in newspapers and online. What had happened with the White House performance was that a Chinese official had approached Tan Mai before President Hu's visit and invited her to perform at the state dinner, sharing the program with an American jazz band. Without thinking twice, Tan Mai, feeling honored, accepted the invitation. But when she saw the list of pieces, she was appalled to find she was to play In Praise of Our Motherland. The song had originally appeared in a 1950s movie about the Battle of Triangle Hill in the Korean War. Its lyrics were embedded with anti-American sentiment. If friends arrive, we have good wine. If wolves come, we have hunting guns. Tan Mai asked if she could play another song in its place, but the Chinese official responded rudely, telling her that she was not in a position to choose. As a protest, she canceled her appearance. They then invited the pianist Lang Lang to play the song in the White House instead, and he was delighted to oblige. The Americans at the banquet were completely unaware of the song's connotations. They applauded Lang Lang's virtuoso performance. President Hu was so pleased by the resounding success that he even hugged the pianist. Later, a newspaper in Taipei reported China's hoodwinking of the Americans with the headline, A Brief Communist Takeover of the White House.
So that's a really great passage. And one of the things that I thought a lot about while I was reading this book is the ways that Americans tend to perceive China as extremely powerful in certain ways. And partly of that power in Americans' minds, I'm saying, comes from the fact that it has an authoritarian government, which doesn't have to argue over things. It can do whatever it wants, right? It doesn't have to debate in Congress like we are now over the infrastructure bills. But the novel, your novel, depicts Chinese officials as very anxious about the country's image And recently we've been hearing reports in the news about the collapse of Evergrande, which is a huge Chinese real estate firm, and that maybe Chinese real estate prices aren't really accurate or could collapse like they collapsed here in America in 2008. Stories, you know, and then earlier in your book, there's a line a character says of China, this country, because I'm quoting now from the book, this country, it was whispered, was like a sinking ship. So which is it?
You know, that saying has been around for decades. That's why all the top officials' children, they have left China. So they made money kind of in a very shady, illegal way, but they hired their wealth outside China. They all believe that China, the country will sink quite soon. But on the other hand, somehow, miraculously, there were always a way to sustain the country from collapsing. It is a powerful country mainly because I think it doesn't have the turnover like, you know, the election. Every 4 years we have a presidential election. Yeah, so we don't have that kind of continuity. One person, once in power, can stay there for a long time. So as a result, the person can build his own subordinates, so consolidate his power. So there's a very strong sense of continuity. So that gave us the feeling that the government somehow is it's stable. But in fact, the economists, they are aware of that. They said that's the superiority of our system in comparison to the U.S. So they really, a lot of policies were made depend on that kind of so-called superiority. Whereas in the States, we don't know, from the foreign country's point of view, we don't know what might happen in 4 years. Even if Biden is very supportive, but what if he's not in power anymore? So that
we're all worried about that.
Yeah, say that.
Problem.
So that's why they use this basically the comments. They really understand the psychology for different, you know, the other countries. So they use this as kind of threat. You know, we are here always. Yeah. So you have to deal with us. It's kind of very disturbing, very disheartening. Even from Biden and from even Trump, their point of view, their children, they have business in China. They would think, when I'm gone, my kids still have business there. So really, that makes China somehow a very strong, very stable in appearance. But in reality, it is not really. There were more than 20,000 foreign businesses have left last year and this year. And a lot of people, millions, tens of millions of people not out of work. So the country is in very terrible shape, very terrible shape.
Do you think people are leaving at this rate because of the crackdown in Hong Kong, or because the economy's not as good, or because the government's policies have been a little bit more strict recently, just as you were talking about earlier in the interview? Or is there a particular reason?
There are various reasons. Hong Kong was a big factor because it showed that the so-called two systems, that kind of compromise would not work. That means the communists will rule every part, everywhere. And also, I think a lot of the top officials, they almost without exception, they all have bank account in Switzerland and in other countries. So they know that the money were made illegally. So once they lose power and they have to protect themselves for the children as well. So and only people at the bottom of society, they buy the propaganda, and their minds have been shaped by propaganda. They believe in the country, partly also because religion has been suppressed. As a result, they deify the country. The irony is, in China, the word for country and the country and the state are the same word, 国家. So they don't make the distinction. the state is the country. That who rules the state? The Communist Party. So the party is the country.
That is such a great answer. Thank you for that. We have one more question that we'd like to ask, and we're going to sign off with you. But we're going to want to go back to Jen, your main character. You've been talking about China's preoccupation in the government with stability and lastingness, you know. But one of his, your character's preoccupations is artistic durability, you know, and even the title is The Song Everlasting, right, over time. Yeah. So how is the desire to make art that lasts connected to the desire to make a political or moral impact, or are those things at odds?
That means we have to really write a good book, a good piece of literature that can last. Really, otherwise, how can we justify that when we write about the people's suffering, misery? And if we don't produce genuine art, then we just utilize their other suffering, right? And a good example would be John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, right? There were books written about the Dust Bowl migration and the depression. And also there were a lot of secondhand knowledge. He did not experience that, but he wrote a great book. So nowadays, when we want to re-experience that migration, we go to that novel. So what is the justification? It is his art that make that experience live and last. So I think that's the reason. You have to produce good work that can justify, that must last, in other words.
Well, we really appreciate you joining us today. And listeners and viewers, don't miss Ha Jin's deeply moving new novel, A Song Everlasting, which is out now. And don't forget, you can listen to this discussion as an episode of the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Vivi. Thank you, Whitney. Very happy to meet you.
Yeah, it's a real treat after enjoying the book so much. And thank you so much also to the Miami Book Fair for inviting us to be part of this conversation. That's it for this episode of the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub. To subscribe to Fiction Nonfiction, please type fiction/non/fiction into your favorite podcast app. We'd love to hear your ideas and feedback. You can reach us at fictionnonfictionpodcast@gmail.com. on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Facebook at FNF Pod, and on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. In each of these places, you'll find links to our LitHub Radio show notes, including some of the readings we mentioned in this episode. You can also find video versions of our episodes on LitHub's virtual book channel and on our YouTube channel. Our website, with our full video and audio archive and episodes grouped by theme for educators, is at fnfpodcast.net. The show is produced by Anne Knigendorf, and we'd also like to thank our student intern producer, Hayden Baker. Until next time, happy reading and writing from Fiction Nonfiction.